This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. And today I'm very happy to be speaking with Madeline Miller. Madeline has a master's degree in the classics from Brown University and has previously been a Latin and Greek teacher. She is most famous, however, as the author and novelist of the best-selling books Circe and Songs of Achilles. Thank you, Madeline, for speaking with us today. And before we get started, and I think this is a really good question for everybody who is listening, how exactly do you pronounce Circe, if I am, in fact, pronouncing it correctly?
That is a great question. So in the ancient context, it would have been with a hard C. It would have been Kirke or Kirpi in Greek is how it's said. But because I feel like people oftentimes get very intimidated by the names, and it can feel very off-putting to, you know, am I pronouncing it right? So what I try and do when I write the novels is I use the form of the name that is most commonly known to the audience. So I use Circe and Achilles as opposed to Achilleus. I use the version of the name that I think the most people know. And then if no one knows the name, then I'll go with the Greek. For example, I did Aiaia, which is the name of Circe's island, as sort of A-I-A-I-A, which is closer to the original Greek than the Latinized version, A-E-A-E-A. So that's my sort of self-invented rule.
Well, I love that rule. I'm a big fan of it, and I might steal it for my future going forward because, you know, also because not everybody knows how it was supposed to be pronounced at all. So it's kind of, it's difficult to have one rule that everybody agrees on. So I like yours.
Yes, well, exactly. As you say, you know, we don't have any recordings from the ancient world. And so, and it's so disputed how things are pronounced, and it's very interesting to go and visit Greece today and realize that the way you're taught to pronounce classical is so, so different. Now, of course, pronunciation has changed, just in English, but it sort of makes you wonder, well, are we being taught? Is reconstructive pronunciation, how accurate is that? So I think there's a lot of room. Whenever people say, I'm worried I can't say the name right, I was like, if you just get it ballpark, you're probably just as close as as anyone else.
Yeah, it's funny when you think about how quickly language and dialects evolve. I mean, you listen to a recording of Jackie O and she sounds so distinct. I mean, why would we think that, you know, 2,000 years we'd be able to figure out exactly what they said?
Yes.
We can try. So I really, really enjoyed your book. And I know you have lots and lots of fans. And for those who haven't read Circe, just as sort of a very, very brief synopsis, it's sort of the story of the witch that you find in the Odyssey, but told from her perspective. And this kind of tactic of telling the perspectives from the villain's view, retelling kind of an old story from a new perspective, often the baddie, is obviously not a new tactic. As I told you before, I'm based in Buenos Aires, so anybody who's a Borges fan might remember the House of Asterion, told from the Minotaur's perspective. But why did you choose, of all of the characters in the ancient world, why Circe? Why did she sort of deserve a fresh look?
She was this character that I had been really drawn to for a really long time, since I was a child. And I think I liked a number of things about her. I really appreciated her witchcraft. That part of what draws me to her power is the fact that witchcraft doesn't come like most divine power. It's not the sort of snap your fingers and suddenly something happens. Witchcraft is much closer to the creative art. It's something that takes time and effort and skill and knowledge. And so all of that, you know, was very appealing to me. I basically saw her as an artist. I also like the fact that she's born into the society where she has very little power. This incredibly patriarchal society that is hostile to female independence, and yet she manages to somehow, through her witchcraft, create her own power, create a life for herself with some independence and some ability to have agency over her own life. I also was drawn to her character because I thought she was really unfairly portrayed. First of all, in Homer, where she immediately has to kind of fold to Odysseus. But actually, even more than in Homer, in later versions after Homer, because usually she does get remembered as a villain in kind of later portraits of her. But she's actually not a villain in Homer. She's frightening. She turns men into pigs. But she also is one of the most helpful characters that Odysseus encounters in the whole Odyssey. And so I sort of felt like this was an example of, yes, I wanted to reclaim sort of a character that's often treated as a villain, but actually I don't think she really is a villain in the earliest versions of her story. And so it was sort of a double wanting to reach back. And I'm always interested in the psychological sort of inner workings of each of my characters. And so one of the big psychological questions that I was really intrigued by with Circe is, why is she turning men into pigs? That is not answered in the Odyssey at all. No one even asks her. And so it sort of seemed like this huge mystery was there. There was this really powerful, interesting woman, and this mystery and this history of her being both misunderstood and kind of flattened as a character. So those things were all irresistible to me.
So it's interesting what you just mentioned, that in Homer, she's not really that much of a bad guy. I mean, yeah, it's not nice to turn men into pigs, but there's obviously much worse things you could do, and characters do. So why did she evolve from the sort of specific details of Homer to being this predatory female? And I know, like, even in the classical time period, but then, like you said, especially in the Renaissance, she becomes like this trope of like the wanton woman and, you know, the sort of evil seductress. Why did that happen, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's the classic fear that we have had in our society for millennia of women with power. And particularly women who have power over men. I mean, that's really what the word witch is, you know, if you look at witch kind of across all the different versions, what witch really means is it's a word that we use for a woman who has an amount of power that is frightening or that is somehow uncontrolled by the people around her. And so I think that it was just fear. She became this sort of embodiment of male anxiety about female power. And so therefore she had to be treated as a villain, because you don't want women thinking that they can just get away with doing something to men and then, you know, being treated as something positive. So she had to be sort of culturally punished, I feel like, in order to keep women in their place. But one of the things that's most interesting, I think, about that portrait of her in Homer is the fact that it's actually told by Odysseus. It's one of the sections of the Odyssey that Odysseus himself narrates. And so not only are we dealing with kind of the, you know, Homeric cultural view of women, but we're dealing with the fact that, like, the ancient literature is telling us this story. And so I feel like now there's a lot of freedom to question and push and say, okay, Odysseus, that's how you claimed it went. Of course you want to emphasize how terrifying she was. And then you want to emphasize how, you know, how sexy she was and how impressive she was, because that makes you look good. But, you know, where's the real woman in this? Where is the woman in her own life, not the woman who's being used as... this is sort of a paraphrase of a line from Margaret Atwood, who's being used as a stick to beat other women, which I think is what is the villainous Circe. So it's very interesting how often that happens to women with power, that they get turned into villains.
That is so interesting. That you point out, we don't really get an accurate portrayal of her because we have such an unreliable narrator. And I mean, Odysseus lies all the time. I mean, so how do we know anything about her, really? And it is interesting, too, when you think about how many times the stories and the mythologies can be so twisted depending on who is telling the story. Like, I often think about that with Euripides, because there's so many characters that, as we think of them today, is the description Euripides gave us. But he was sort of famous in the classical world for twisting a story that everybody knew. So you think of, like, Medea, like, he's the one who made her kill her children. I mean, in the original Corinthian versions, the townspeople kill her. Like, she doesn't seem like such a villain. And now, today, we think of Medea, and we're like, ooh, you know, the woman who killed her children. Like, wow, that's evil.
Exactly. And he usually gets credit for her because he puts some lines in her mouth about, it's much harder to endure childbirth than it is to endure war, and sort of talking about the lot of women and how women are disrespected. And I think he deserves some credit for that, but I think you're absolutely right that he is the one who is making her do the infamous, most monstrous thing possible. That, you know, it's almost as if he was afraid of how sympathetic he made her portrait.
Yeah. You're like, oh, if only
that's,
you knew.
Like, analyze real.
I got to say, I do love this sort of trend at the moment where we're kind of re-examining characters and both historical and fictional from the ancient world and taking our sort of modern perspectives on them. And it kind of made me think of other ways that we can, I guess, understand and appreciate the classics from our modern world. So, for instance, when I think of the age of heroes, it's sort of men and gods communicating with each other very directly. And that's not something we really do anymore. I mean, if somebody does say they're communicating with gods, they usually get locked up and given some extreme medication. So it's something that's a little bit less relatable to us. So I was curious if this was a theme that you see in mythology, or one that you sort of put in the book. And or maybe I'm just totally making stuff up and theorizing out loud here, but that there's sort of maybe a class element as well, between sort of the gods and the heroes and the mortals. Like you said, that one of the things you liked about Circe is that, you know, she worked hard, and that made me think of, like, serfs or something, you know, having to toil the land versus, like, the aristocracy where they just, you know, are given all of their wealth and powers and beauty, and they don't have to work for it. They don't appreciate it.
So I really, that is definitely something that I think is there. And I think the ancients even, that I would argue that Virgil's Aeneid, that the gods are very much stand-ins for the political elite, people who had so much power that they were basically like gods. And so I think you can absolutely see that, you know, and this is where I see so many resonances. I mean, the ancients had a saying, nothing new under the sun. And I think that is pretty much right. And I think we are struggling right now with, you know, a time period where the people who have the most amount of wealth and power have so much money that it is kind of like our gods. They're almost completely, you know, isolated from any sort of consequence or from anything, you know, ever going wrong. And one of the things, so I think it's interesting that very strong class structure does exist, that the gods are basically these all-powerful beings who have, you know, unlimited resources and power that just comes to them from inheritance. They're born with it, but it's not good for them. That's what I think is really interesting, is that the Greek gods are really monstrous.
Yeah.
Compared to humans, that humans are much more apt than gods in the ancient material. And in fact, when Achilles is acting at his most vicious and brutal and vengeful and bloodthirsty, he's said to be acting like a god. And so that's really interesting to me that, you know, and this is something that actually modern psychology has shown, that the more power and privilege you have, unless you actively work against it. And it is possible to work against it if you're aware. Empathy starts going down. And I feel like the ancients understood that intuitively. They understood that it's not good for humans to become so distant from our empathy to other humans. And so I very much think that the gods can be read as a metaphor, or at least as kind of an echo of that.
Yeah, if only more people were sort of aware of that. I mean, we live in a society today, I think, that everyone sort of pushes the main goal is to be, you know, the most beautiful, the most rich, the most famous, the most successful, but that very few people question if that will actually make them happy or moral. And I wonder if in the ancient world, because that level of success was, I don't know, quarantined, maybe confined to like deity, people might not have aimed for it. And nowadays we're like, well, yeah, sure, I can be Kim Kardashian if I just get enough followers on Instagram or something. You know, that because we don't realize that we shouldn't even try for that, or that it's so beyond our reach. I don't know, maybe that makes us less happy.
Yes, exactly. And I think I think other cycle of that, which is that, you know, beyond, once you sort of meet a basic level of need and safety, and, you know, once a person has enough food and safety and shelter, anything above that doesn't actually increase their happiness, and indeed may decrease it, increases their distance from other people.
Yeah, it's...
This is all my background in psychology, which I find human psychology so interesting and engaging. I don't have a degree in it because my school didn't have minors, but I would have had a minor if my school did. And I loved digging into sort of the ways that these ancient works, although, you know, they don't have the same words for psychological things that we do today, you know, things like PTSD are absolutely visible in the ancient literature. And I think it's always interesting to me to see how humans are still struggling with a lot of these same kind of big questions.
Well, I think that your interest in psychology really shows in your characters, because they're so vivid, and they're so, I mean, you see their motivations, their reactions. I think that really brings them to life. And, you know, I got to say, it must be one of the things that for people who study the classics absolutely loves, because you get to run into all these characters that you have always read about, and make them, they seem so alive. And I think in a weird way, it must be comparable to how the ancients felt, you know, when they got to chapter 10 in the Odyssey, and, you know, Odysseus is in the underworld, and he runs into all these, you know, the who's who of the ancient Greek mythology, and the readers would have been like, oh yeah, look, here's Ajax, and, you know, here's Achilles, and oh great, we get to see them again. And so for modern readers, it that's how it feels like, when you're like, oh look, here's Jason and Medea, when you're reading Circe. It's quite a lot of fun. But I was wondering, the characters are so real, like how did you do your research? Like where what kind of resources were you able to kind of use to bring these characters just so alive?
So I try and kind of look at all the ancient portraits or references to the various characters. And I don't, I'm very grateful for my academic background in classics, but I also have come to realize that I have to trust my novelist's sensibilities. So I sort of use that academic research, but then I don't, I kind of sift through it a little bit like a magpie. You know, what are the shiny things, the things that are catching my attention? And then my imagination kind of starts to work on those things. So I don't try and be exhaustive for the most part with characters. So I don't use absolutely every myth about Circe out there. First of all, many of them are contradictory.
Yeah.
But I also, you know, it's important for me to just sort of follow, well, what is the story I'm interested in telling? What are the pieces that make sense to me? With Odysseus, part of what I wanted to do is bring in a bunch of myths about him that are not in the Odyssey. I think people have a artificially positive view of Odysseus from the Odyssey. So I would say that the Odyssey is probably the most positive portrait of Odysseus from the ancient world, and it's still, as you know, not that positive. Whereas in a lot of the tragedies or in the Iliad, he's much more openly villainous, and everyone sort of acknowledges that, that he's ruthless and unscrupulous, and he'll definitely stab you in the back. And so I wanted to bring in some of these other myths about Odysseus, and it's been really fun to have readers say to me, why do you hate Odysseus? It's like, I don't hate him. Those are all myths about him that exist. Most of them are from the Iliad. But they don't reflect quite so well on him. So I have always seen Odysseus as a very complicated character. And, you know, it's one of the things that interests me about him is this sort of this idea of honor. So one of the things he does in the Iliad is he kills a bunch of sleeping, unarmed Trojan allies. Mm-hmm. It's the type of thing that you could never imagine Achilles or Ajax doing, unless Achilles was in his, you know, his rage once Patroclus is killed. So it's a very dishonorable thing to do. On the other hand, it's a type of thing that wins wars. And ultimately, that's what Odysseus is trying to do. He's trying to win the war and end the war and go home. And so, you know, it's very pragmatic. On the other hand, if the war drags on forever, then you're going to be losing more life that way. So I wanted his pragmatism to be kind of front loaded. I'm very interested in his pragmatism and how that pragmatism can sometimes become cruel. But how it's this core identity thing for him. So I really just, through all the material, gathered everything I could find and then let sort of the muse, the inspiration, my connection to the material guide me as to what pieces to use and whatnot.
I liked, by the way, how you said a complicated man, because it made me think of the first line of the Odyssey as translated by Emily Wilson, you know, the let me tell you a story of a complicated man. And it is interesting because, you know, I've read interviews from her too, where she was saying like, yeah, you know, if I wanted to, I could tell you this is a story of a wayfaring husband or an unfaithful husband. It is interesting how when we translate, even now, different translations, just how different we can portray these characters and just completely alter the narrative about, you know, the entire purpose of the Odyssey, just from the first line.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm so glad you brought up Emily Wilson, because I think her translation is brilliant. I think she's brilliant. And I think her translation should be standard reading for all people reading the Odyssey. But on top of it, I love her introduction for just that reason, because what she does is she says, you know, there's this sort of been this veneer that some translators use of being objective. And she says, you know, all translation is interpretation. I am definitely having to make interpretive choices as I go through the poem. And I love that she's very upfront about that. And she's talking about how she is trying to use those interpretations very deliberately to try and sort of highlight things in the text, one of which is, as she eloquently talks about, the women that Odysseus orders killed at the end of the Odyssey, which traditionally the word for them has been translated as maids, the maids. And the word in Greek is female slave. And that's just a very different feel for us reading it as a modern audience. You know, a maid implies someone who maybe gets paid and home at night and possibly has some choice of where they work, as opposed to someone who is being owned as property, has no consent, no ability to refuse or accept, really. And so I think she very eloquently talks about how important it is to be thoughtful about the way we are choosing those interpretations.
Well, especially because, I mean, he kills them because they slept with the suitors. And of course, if you just make it sound like they had any agency in that, then it makes it almost well, not justifies, obviously, but at least explains why he's done it. But if they're slaves and they've obviously just been raped, then I don't know, it doesn't seem to make any sense that they get murdered for that. And I think even in some translations, to make Odysseus seem less cruel, you know, they're even suggested to being promiscuous. I mean, to really even justify Odysseus.
Exactly, as opposed, right, as if it's okay to kill a promiscuous woman. So, you know, that has its own problem. But exactly as you say, these women were enslaved. There was, I mean, this was rape. Any sexual relationship that they had with the suitors, you know, they didn't really have the consent to say no. So, absolutely. I think it's such a troubling, it's such a troubling moment in the Odyssey. But even more troubling than that moment is the fact of how I think people who love the Odyssey and love Odysseus have either, you know, through just being misguided or through being, you know, I don't know what the word would be, nefarious, have tried to conceal those problematic aspects.
Yeah, I think it's good of us today to, I mean, I like as an exercise to sort of knock people off their pedestals every now and then. But it almost makes me wonder, like, because we sort of, I don't know, I don't know if today we like having our heroes just a bit more simple. Like they have to all be good or idealized. In the ancient world, would they have thought Odysseus was a great guy? Or would they just said, yeah, you know, he's kind of evil also. It's just more interesting. Or did they think that some of the evil aspects of him were totally socially acceptable in that day and age?
Well, I think you're asking a really, really great question. And you know, our idea of heroes today is to be this totally positive figure. And, you know, when we say the word hero, we mean someone who is like a moral exemplar. But when we talk about heroes in the ancient Greek context, that's not really what they meant. If anything, I think it's more akin to like Olympic athletes or celebrities. Yeah. That these were flawed, very human people. They had big strengths and they also had weaknesses. And, you know, absolutely would have critiqued Odysseus in the ancient world and would have critiqued Achilles in the ancient world. And none of these heroes, I think, were held up as paragons of virtue. Except for maybe Aeneas for a while, actually. Pious Aeneas.
Yeah,
I would argue that by the end of the Aeneid, Virgil has thoroughly disabused us of that.
I guess Penelope, there's not really anything bad you could say about Penelope.
That's true. But I think that actually is a little bit of a different function, which is that women either sort of, I feel like women in the ancient mythology have to be sort of either, you know, these perfect, I mean, Penelope and Clytemnestra are such interesting foils, bad, faithless, murderous woman. Penelope is the woman who, you know, does absolutely everything for her husband, holds everything together, is faithful. Now, I think that there's a lot more room to complicate that portrait of Penelope and to look at how clever she is and sort of imagine an inner life for her. But she was definitely seen as sort of all perfectly good, and women sort of had to be perfect or had to be bad.
I do like, though, that she, I mean, I feel at least that she's more clever than Odysseus in that she tricks him right at the end of the Odyssey with regards to the bed. So that, like, in one way, she outsmarts like one of the smartest guys. It's kind of like a triumph for good old Penny.
Oh, I totally agree. I think Homer absolutely presents her as more intelligent than Odysseus. Yeah.
I know. Maybe that comes to a support of perhaps Homer was a woman after all, we don't know. But can I, just to go veer in a slightly different direction, with regards to talking about the classics in this day and age, from your experiences, what do you think that there's a lot of people who have misconceptions about the Hellenistic world and the classical world in general?
Sure, and I do think that there are a lot of misconceptions. And I think that some of those misconceptions, if we're being really honest, extends to classicists, because the truth of the matter is that the historical record is so filled with holes. And that oftentimes when we're looking through at the ancient world, it's kind of like we're looking through, you know, like a peephole, and we can only see this one portion. One of the things that I think is a huge missing piece is we don't really have very many voices of women from the ancient world. You know, we have Sappho, but her poems are kind of in shreds.
Yeah.
And we have some sort of documents of women in court cases, but how exactly accurate those speeches are, question mark. And so we know very little about a lot of different types of, you know, about women's lives, about the lives of people who were not aristocrats, because a lot of the writers who were writing were at least, you know, from the kind of the ruling class, the political and educated elite. So, of course, there are misconceptions, and I think there are a lot of question marks. So, and then I think you have this sort of like fetishization that's happening right now of certain aspects of ancient culture, like the obsession with the Spartans and the Battle of Thermopylae and the sort of co-opting of these classical things to try and as, you know, by the alt-right, which Donna Zuckerberg has talked about really eloquently. So then you have that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because for people who just love learning about ancient history and culture, I mean, for me, like, one of the things I love about it is the perspective it gives in my own existence, that, like, you know, people have thought and worried about the same stuff for thousands of years, and, you know, that kind of, like, going through time and time traveling. But it is weird when you realize, like, almost naively, how many people politicize history. And, you know, sometimes it has been to our advantage when you think of, like, Mussolini, you know, helping out with all of the archaeological sites and have those finds. I mean, obviously, I'm not a Mussolini fan. Don't get me wrong. I don't want anyone to take that out of context. So it is weird when you kind of realize that, I guess, anything can be political, but, or Pericles said, you know, if you're not interested in politics, politics will take an interest in you. But it makes it a difficult path to find, I suppose, and to promote without people maybe misconceiving that the purpose.
Yes, exactly. I love that you brought up the Mussolini thing, because I think so often people have used classics to justify their own decisions. I mean, the Nazis loved the classics, which is, I think, in itself terrifying. And how often that, you know, this material is invested with a kind of cultural authority, which people then claim to kind of boost there. So I think we have to be very thoughtful about that with classics.
Well, I got to say, I love
interesting history. The history of classics.
The history of classics. Well, and I think, you know, like at Classical Wisdom, like, we're doing a website to try to just make it less academic or ivory tower-ish. You know, just trying to show people that this really practical things you can learn from the ancient world, or really interesting stories that, you know, they've survived thousands of years for a reason. And I feel like that's what that you're also doing with your books, that just making it accessible and showing the stories are awesome. They're really, really cool. I mean, you almost want to, like, tell sometimes the academic world, like, get out of the way of making it less interesting than it is.
Yes. I mean, that's what I love about these ancient stories, is exactly what you're talking about. I feel like there is so much wisdom to be found in them, so much, you know, cycles of history, of human nature. There is just an eternal richness to them.
So do you feel like the classics are very male-centric? Like, what else can we be doing to make it more inclusive?
Well, I will give you an example of what not to do, which is on the first day of one of my classes when I was in college. And this is this was a very unusual situation for me. For the most part, my classics professors were incredibly welcoming, supportive, and progressive in the way they approached the text. But this particular professor said, this is a class about Greek history, so I don't want any questions about women or slaves, which I think is just, could not be more offensive and shocking. I think we were all, everyone in the audience was just completely stunned that he had actually said this. Yeah. And so I think making sure that we are looking at classics and sort of taking into account the voices that we may not be hearing, you know, right at the surface level, looking at the lives of women, just kind of keep turning the kaleidoscope and making sure that we're not leaving out important voices and important perspectives. And I think making sure that we're supporting all kinds of different scholars approaching these texts, even if the way they're approaching them may be different from the way they've been approached in the past. You know, we're not going to hurt the class. Classics are going to be totally fine. They're going to outlive us all. So just making sure that we don't have sort of a phobia about people approaching them in new ways. It's not going to break. I think we should be supporting new voices and new interpretations.
Well, and I think that if you are a lover of history, any new information is just going to fill out the picture more fully. I mean, it'll just give you a more accurate and more truthful version. So if we've been, you know, imagine you're painting a picture and we've been painting certain sections of it, of course, we're just going to learn more by seeking to find out the sections that haven't been filled. It's just, seems like it's just in pursuit of truth we should be doing that.
Right, exactly.
So just to conclude, because you've been so generous with your time, can you let me know what you're working on now?
So right now, I've mentioned Virgil a couple times, so I have a long-term project on the Aeneid working on, and I love Virgil and I love the Aeneid, so I'm really looking forward to that. And then the other thing, actually, that I do is I direct Shakespeare plays. And so I'm really interested in The Tempest, and I've been thinking about The Tempest for a long time. And The Tempest is a very classically influenced play. There's a lot of Virgil and Ovid in The Tempest. So I sort of feel like I'm getting to keep one foot in the classical world, even as I look at The Tempest. So The Tempest and the Aeneid, but I'm not sure what order.
Whoa, that sounds very exciting. Well, I'd love to see the direction of how you take on The Tempest, and I know all of our listeners will definitely be watching out for whatever next book comes out. I know you have quite a lot of fans, so it's been a real pleasure getting the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you so very much for having me, and thank you for keeping the Classics flame burning.
Yes, and I'll make sure to put links below as well to your recent books and anything else that you're working on.
Thank you so much.